Good morning. Pop open the champers. It's Boris time.
And I know some waggles already pointed out that Deliver, Unite and Defeat was not the perfect acronym for an election campaign, since unfortunately it spells dud. But they forgot the final E, my friends. E for energise. And I say to all the doubters, dude.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
Oh yeah, it's alright.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
For it has come to pass that Boris Johnson is the new Prime Minister of our nearest neighbour.
But then
we are going to energise the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do. And we are once again going to believe in ourselves and what we can achieve. And like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity with better education, better infrastructure, more police, fantastic full fibre broadband sprouting in every household. We are going to unite this amazing country and we are going to take it forward. I thank you all very much for the incredible honour that you have just done me. I will work flat out from now on with my team that I will build, I hope, in the next few days to repay your confidence. But in the meantime, the campaign is over and the work begins. Thank you all very much.
So tight, I couldn't unwind. I saw so much, I broke my mind. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
And it seemed that almost everyone had an opinion on the tousled-haired Etonian who was determined to add the E into proceedings across the pond. Miriam O'Callaghan canvassed opinion on Boris just ahead of the result. Here's Kevin Maguire of the Daily Mirror.
He says one thing, does another, changes his mind more than he does his socks. Remember, he said Theresa May's Brexit deal, he opposed it twice and voted for it. He said it would turn Britain into a slave state. Well, he was quite happy to do that in the end. And he's such a tricky character. Now, when you're in opposition within a government or in opposition in Parliament, you can get away with that. You cannot do that when you're in Downing Street and you have to make decisions.
All right then, so what did political commentator Michael Crick have to say on the matter?
Boris Johnson is not a details man. He will rely hugely on the people around him. We saw that when he was Mayor of London. But we also saw when he was Foreign Secretary, he can be hugely gaffe-prone. And it's those gaffes on the international stage that could cause him huge problems at a time right now when Britain has fewer friends in the world than it has, you know, probably ever. We're in for a real roller coaster ride, I think.
A roller coaster, eh? Well, even those who claimed to know Boris Johnson well and broadly supported him seemed to have a slightly bemused catch in their voice when they spoke about him. Miriam O'Callaghan asked Edwina Curry what she thought about her new PM.
Like him or loathe him, Boris Johnson is box office. There's no doubt about that. There are several things about him, I think, that many people don't understand. The first is that he's a seriously brainy guy. You know, they say, oh, Eton, all the rest of it. He got a scholarship to Eton. He got top scholarship to Oxford. This is a man who really has a serious brain. You do classics, you're doing it in several ancient languages. But he's not an economist. He's not a numbers man. He's a romantic historian, if you like. And if you're looking for consistency, there's no point whatever, Miriam, in quoting back to him what he said or did even 6 weeks ago. You know, that's a different matter. He has an element of unpredictability about
but
him,
isn't
an
that
element
terrifying?
Of pragmatism about him. No, that's not terrifying. That's what serious politics is about.
Oh, a little bit scary there, Edwina. Anyway, Miriam asked her this.
Edwina Curry, what's he like as a person?
Oh, I know his father better than I know him. It strikes me that he's actually quite similar to his hero, Winston Churchill. I think he wants to be loved. I think he wants to be admired. And that's actually probably a good thing because it means that he really will strive to produce a result that he has promised to the electorate, to the members of the Conservative Party. He wants to go down in history as a success. I don't think he's particularly bothered by going down in history. He's a good man, or, you know, great husband, father, and all that kind of stuff. And I think he enjoys being a bit of a buffoon, because that is the way that you often get publicity for something you care about a lot. I noticed, for example, the film of the tripwire of him whizzing around when he was Mayor of London is still there. What I noticed was he did not drop the Union flags. He clung on to them as to dear life. He was concentrating hard. It'll be fascinating. If anything else, it's going to be a lot more interesting than it was under Theresa May, who, bless her, was very, very boring.
Perish the thought. Well, that was Edwina Curry with Miriam. But another person who knew Boris Johnson well was former Conservative MP and convicted perjurer Reverend Jonathan Aiken. What did he make of the incoming PM?
Well, I think he'll be full of surprises. He'll be a high-risk, high-reward kind of prime minister. I know Boris pretty well, and he is a force. It's arguable whether he's a force for good or not, but he's certainly a force who will, I think, for good, energise a lot of, okay, I hope, new good ministers and do it well.
Well, maybe so. So how best to negotiate with a man for whom detail is dull and consistency is, well, just not his thing? Bertie Ahern, no slouch in the negotiating realm, had some insight.
I think the problem is he's now set himself, he's been elected on a Brexit mandate out by the 31st of October. In my view, it's impossible to deliver that.
Do you believe he'll do it?
No, I don't. I don't think he's a hope in hell in achieving it. What he might do, you know, he's a clever guy, there's no doubt about that, and he can be quite articulate when he wants to be, and he can be a bluster when he wants to be. So he's a smart dude, well educated, and he knows politics. He's been writing about it and involved in it for a long time, so he knows the game well. I think he will try. He will come in with a head of steam to try and deal with the issue, but I'd be surprised if he doesn't try to broaden the agenda from day one. I mean, he's watched the last 3 years of Britain being just transfixed by Brexit. People probably fed up with it. He will try and broaden the agenda out into social issues and try to revive the Tory party and just not just be Brexit. Because I can't see him winning on Brexit. I mean, what he can do is try, go to Europe, talk to us, see what progress he can get. If he finds it impossible, he can say, oh, they're all too unreasonable and I need a new mandate. And go off to the country.
Bertie Ahern speaking with Miriam O'Callaghan. Well, Boris met the Queen and his appointment of Prime Minister was confirmed, and thus the cabinet cull began. Some were fired, some resigned, and what was left around the table was a team of staunch Brexiteers. And Boris set out his ginger beer stall on Wednesday.
It has become clear that there are pessimists at home and abroad who think, after 3 years of indecision, that this country has become a prisoner to the old arguments of 2016. And in this home of democracy, we are incapable of honouring a democratic mandate. And so I am standing before you today to tell you, the British people, that those critics are wrong. The doubters, the doomsters, the gloomsters, they are going to get it wrong again. The people who bet against Britain are going to lose their shirts, because we're going to restore trust in our democracy.
Drive Time's Sarah McInerney asked Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant, columnist and former government advisor, to give his verdict on Boris's speech.
We're leaving the European Union on the 31st of October, quote, no ifs or buts, unquote. That was the bottom line. It was superbly written, well delivered in the sort of Gilbert and Sullivan style. It was rollicking. But when you disaggregate the content, what was undoubtedly a highly competent performance, you know, there's large gaps in between what were very confident assertions. But there's no sense of the consequence for him and for his economy that he extols in the case of no deal. He says he doesn't believe it will be as bad as some, and those some are named very clearly in the clip you replayed there, Sarah. They are called pessimists. And I think that naming and cornering of the others is very instructive about his political approach. You are a British and therefore optimistic by nature. You are prepared to carry the can of the democratic decision. But if you're not, you are a pessimist, you're a doubter, you're a doomster, you're a gloomster. And it really is saying that these people, the Remainers, are almost a fifth column.
Gerard Howlin on Wednesday. Thursday was Boris Johnson's first day on the job, and he took Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons for 2.5 hours. And drive time brought us some highlights, including this question from Labour's Tony Benn.
The Prime Minister set out his new Brexit policy, but did he notice that yesterday the Taoiseach said that any suggestion that a whole new negotiation could be undertaken in weeks or months is not in the real world? If Leo Varadkar is right, and as a consequence the House of Commons votes in the autumn against leaving the European Union on the 31st of October without an agreement, what will the Prime Minister's policy be then?
Resign.
I thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think that what the Right Honourable Gentleman has said is redolent of the kind of defeatism and negativity that we've had over the last... Why begin by assuming that our EU friends will not wish to compromise? I think they have every reason to want to compromise, and that is what we will seek a compromise. And I respectfully say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, and to all Honourable and Right Honourable Members, that it is now our collective responsibility to get this done.
Come on, chaps, don't be an easier. Chin up. Well, that was Boris in the House of Commons. Sarah McInerney asked Ronan McRae, Professor of Constitutional and European Law at University College London, what might happen if Boris Johnson held to this hardline approach.
Everything that he said in the last 24 hours suggests he has no interest in cosmetic changes. He's being very black and white about the whole issue. So if he continues in that position, that black and white type of position, the backstop must be gone, we want a new deal, a better deal, open renegotiations, etc., is Ireland going to come under pressure from Brussels?
I don't think Ireland will come under pressure from Brussels. I think Ireland will come under pressure from itself. Because the rest of the EU, the EU 26, they'll be hurt a bit by a no-deal Brexit, but it won't be catastrophic. But for us, it is catastrophic. And that's the thing, we've been caught in a way in the fact that we're on a really strong negotiating team who feel free to walk away because it won't kill them. But it will kill us.
Ooh, this is not good. Well, last word on the whole thing to Tommy Gorman on Friday's Morning Ireland.
We're into a new phase of Love Island and it's very, very unstable.
I think we might be in for one long, hot summer. Well, borders and belonging were to the fore on Pantisocracy this week. Panty Bliss remembered her very first visit to Belfast at the age of 17, where it was kind of like looking in a slightly rippled mirror. It was more than just the crossing of a physical barrier. It highlighted differences, both overt and subtle.
I mean, it looked like Ireland and had names like Ireland. There was Tato and Weather and Light, just like Ireland. But the train station floor was rubber, like in a train station in London. And the money was different, and the taxis were black, and the radio they played in the taxis were the BBC, and the bread was called Veda. And on the train home, a polite but disinterested soldier got on and asked to see my passport and poke my portfolio, which was weird.
Well, that was visit number one. But by the time she was 30, Panty Bliss was strutting her stuff in Belfast every week at the gay club, The Kremlin. And it was a brave new world. Mostly.
By then, thanks to the Good Friday Agreement, the border had become invisible and no one asked for ID and nobody poked our bags. And every week the little weirdnesses, well, they lost their weirdness by familiarity and it started to feel ordinary, or mostly ordinary anyway, because there were always other little weirdnesses to discover. Once, while chatting to a barman in the club we worked in, he said he came from a mixed marriage. And I thought, well, he must have been adopted because he didn't look mixed race to me. And even in the gay bars, which had always been mixed, people still avoided giving their last names or saying what part of the city they came from, and definitely not the school they went to.
So a certain lingering guarded wariness, but country miles better than it had been in the dark days before 1998. But Panty Bliss sounded a note of caution as she remembered her Belfast dancing days and thought of what might be ahead and how very easy it might be to return to that country.
The thing about the past is that it's never actually in the past. The past doesn't just pass by, it lingers in the present. It passes by, but trails tendrils behind it that slip and whisk through the present, often unnoticed, but occasionally getting tangled in today, and like a poltergeist, it can shift or push or knock things over, sometimes suddenly. It leaves grooves that we are hardly aware of until we trip in one. And sometimes we do forget. We forget so entirely that we stumble into a groove we once knew well, but now we don't even recognize it. And before you know what's happened, we're back where we've already been. Before you know it, there's a disinterested soldier poking your bag, and it doesn't seem weird at all. It seems all too familiar.
From Pantosocracy on Tuesday night, we will be back and Brexit free, I promise, after this break. Welcome back. Now, the weekend, and frankly, much of the week, was dominated by the win of Shane Lowry at the Golf Open. There was a huge outpouring of affection for the Offaly native, who was universally praised as being a down-to-earth man whose win was begrudged by no one. And Minister Shane Ross set the tone with this celebratory and, frankly, devil-may-care offer.
Whatever Shane Lowry wants, he will certainly get.
Well, so what did Shane Lowry want? Well, first port of call was Dublin City Centre to relax and celebrate. So, with the main man out of reach of the microphone and radio time to fill, immediate family became the next port of call. And it very quickly became clear that the Lowry family had more than one star in their stable. Step up Granny Emmy, as heard on the news at 1.
I remember I minded them while the mother was working, you know. They were building a house in Provana. He was always on the go. I had a turf box in the corner beside the range. And when I go up to the close and I pour him into it, he'd have all the turf mowed out and then I'd come back. So whether it worked his immune system or what, I don't know. But he got there anyway. And great cousin he was. He was always full of life and full of go. And I should look where he used to be and I was in a great.
Was it tough watching at the weekend?
Oh, terrible. Emotional now it was. I hadn't slept last night. I hadn't drank a brandy since 2009. I drank 2 years and it nearly killed me. It was great to live to see all this happening, you know. It gave our little town a great boost. I remember he won the Mullingar Scratch Cup and he came home and I was shouting at him. He said, go out there and bring me in a bucket of turf. He said to him, shut up, Emmy. He says, you won't see Tiger Woods bringing in turf.
A very charming Emily Scanlon has heard on the news at 1, and it's no surprise that Joe Duffy wanted in on the Emmy action.
Never. Emmy, good afternoon,
yes,
Emmy.
She's
on the other line. Emmy Scanlon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Congratulations.
And thank you very much.
What a magnificent achievement.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. It's great. It's absolutely great for everyone.
And he is a jolly
He's
man,
isn't
he?
He's a jolly lad. Well, so am I. You had I to know. Be jolly when you were around 13.
13 at him?
Yes. I was Clara and Mrs. Brown that time. Yes.
What? 13, and what was the mix, boys and girls?
10 boys and 3 girls.
Wow.
All reared up hard, worked hard. Myself and my husband, he's dead now, 10 years, Lord rest him.
Yeah.
And I got a job then when he died, caretaking the cemetery above. So I'm still working at 82.
You're the caretaker of the cemetery?
I'm the caretaker of the cemetery. I work for the county council. I keep the books for the new cemetery.
And have you many people working for you in the cemetery?
I have a skeleton staff and it's great. No problem.
Fair play.
Oh, and just like that, Joe fell. I think it was the skeleton staff quip, but Joe and Emmy started a rather special relationship that ran for the whole show. And while people called in to praise Shane Lowry, Joe asked the most Irish of questions.
He won't lose the run of himself, will he?
Oh, God, no, he won't. Oh, God, no, he won't. No, no. Like, you know, I'd be brought places and, you know, I'd be, you know, I'm a bit like Mrs. Brown. I say not our left word. That's my medication. And, you know, and I'd be checking up on me.
Yeah.
So I get very hard. I like to be myself, you know, and I hope Shane will be the very same.
Oh, you wouldn't want to lose the run of yourself. There'd be no greater crime than that. Now, Joe at this stage is positively wetting himself. And then it transpires that Emmy can sing. And here, she displays just the right amount of little on me. Oh, I couldn't possibly. Oh, if you insist, give C. Hit it.
So, Emily, Sean was saying you have a little song yourself there.
Ah, no. Oh, Christ, Jesus. You want me to sing now, do you? Yeah. You want me to finish it off now?
Yes, please, yeah.
Well, I will.
Okay, what's it called, Emily?
It's a little town of Clara. Well, it's the new one. It's
oh,
not
the new
the
one.
The old one's too long.
Yeah, the 192-OOY one, the new reg. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Happy were my childhood days on the streets of Clara Town. I took a stroll up Frederick Street with the young lass by my side.
And such a beautiful voice. But then all the Liveline stars aligned when they got this call.
Hello, Joe, Emmy.
Hello, Daniel.
I loved your song. Absolutely loved it. And I'm delighted to be able to congratulate you. And by congratulating you, I send it to Shane. We are so, so proud of his achievement yesterday, and indeed since he turned pro. And we really, just yesterday was a wonderful day for Ireland to see him lift that carrot jug.
But Joe Duffy was anxious to put the spotlight back on Emily Scanlon.
And I know, Daniel, the reason you contacted us, I know it's congratulations, Shane, but when you heard Emmy Scanlon singing.
I loved it. It's a beautiful song. And you are a class singer, not just because you're Shane's granny today and everybody is on a high, but you, I'll tell you something, it's not your first time to open your mouth.
No, you're revolting me last, hopefully.
No, well, I tell you, it's no harm for you.
Yeah, it
was lovely, you're a beautiful singer.
And we'll finish up with Joe Duffy looking for a potential regular for Funny Friday.
I think we'll have to get you an agent.
No, what?
Get you an agent.
It's a wheelchair I want, not an agent. Go away with that.
She's a tonic. That was the rather deadly Emily Scanlon with Joe Duffy on Monday. But let's not forget Shane Lowry, a man whose humility and good nature made him a hero to all of the country. And this is what he had to say when he stepped onto the podium in Clara.
I just like to say thanks to everybody for coming out. Thanks to everyone for their support over the years. The last time I remember seeing something like this was in 98 when I went to Tullamore for the homecoming of the hurlers winning the All-Ireland. So for me to be able to do something like this, look at it. I can't believe it. Like, it's mad, isn't it? Like,
Golf Open winner Shane Lowry. And of course now with the Ryder Cup coming to Adair Manor in 2026, we might all have to learn to speak the golf. Staying with a vaguely sporting theme, historian and archivist Katrina Crowe was the guest on Second Captain Saturday. And she wasn't mincing her words when it came to social media. No Insta stories for her.
The whole maelstrom of madness on social media. I have never done Facebook or Twitter, and I never will, because in the beginning, I didn't believe that I should give any information to major multinational corporations and make Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey richer than they already are. They don't need it. And I certainly don't want to be handing out stuff. And then it became clear that the levels of idiocy and anger and madness that are showing up on these things, who has time for that? Nobody.
Hmm. But because of that sort of tidal flood of like information and assertion and emotion and all of the stuff that kind of makes up the atmosphere that we now inhabit, mm-hmm. what place is there left for sort of forensic investigation of things in the distant past? And even you could also argue what relevance does it now have in a world which is so different, in a world which is shaped by these technologies that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. When you study the past, people often talk about history. It's important to understand the past in order to understand the present. But I honestly don't see how understanding most of the past up to this point tells you anything about the present.
Ooh, said the presenter to the historian.
Oh dear. What happened to you?
I don't
How
to
do
talking
you
about
not
Rick,
think
yeah.
that understanding the Great Depression, the golden age in late 19th century Europe and America, which is very similar to what we're experiencing now, the result of it, the Great Depression and the responses to it, have nothing to teach us now? So how do people want to get accurate information about the world around them is the real question. And that would include not just history. And I would certainly tell you that even the study of ancient history has a vast amount to tell us about how our species has developed over time, about ideas of power and downfall, about empires that rise and fall, about the lives of ordinary people who had to endure all of this and manage often very ingeniously to keep up with it. All of this is both inspirational and educational and useful. I am a fanatic for history. Fascinates me. I would just as easily read a book about the Stone Age as I would about the 18th century or the 20th century and be very happy to do so. There's so much we don't know and so much yet to be discovered. Mm. That to me is wonderful. that weren't. There are mysteries still all over the historical landscape that are there for us to investigate and to find out about with proper evidence.
Katrina Crowe putting manners on the lads on Second Captains. But what was the story with her and George Best?
Is it true that you also spent a summer in Manchester in the late 1960s with the express mission to follow George Best around the place?
Not really.
We can exaggerate for effect.
Yeah.
Who cares about truth and accuracy of history? let's jazz it up as much as we want.
No, I think every girl in the world was in love with George Best in the 1960s. He was the fifth Beatle. He was gorgeous. And yes, I was crazy about him. And not alone was he gorgeous, he was incredibly talented. And I know he's a womanizer, but you know, I can fix him. And I know he's a drunkard, but I can fix that too. Oh, the delusions of adolescence. And I did see him once outside the Shambles, which was the main sort of old Elizabethan bar in Manchester at the time. But I was far too nervous and starstruck to go and say anything to him. So I missed my chance. Who knows what might have happened?
That could have been a game changer. That was Katrina Crowe on Second Captains. Now, have a listen to something quite extraordinary.
The piece will start in Ross Island in Antarctica at 80 degrees south. On this deep, black tongue of lava and pumice surrounded by ice and snow. And then slowly travel northwards, following the songs of humpback whales as they navigate through the terrain of the deep ocean on their journey north around the Galapagos Islands above and below the surface, and then out to the west coast of Ireland to a place which may or may not exist one day every 7 years. And then passing into the freezing waters of the Arctic and around Svalbard at 80 degrees north as the sea slowly grinds to a halt and seawater becomes sea ice. And the hydrophones below the surface collect the remarkable, haunting voices of bearded seals singing in the darkness.
Mesmerisingly beautiful. That was sound artist Chris Watson with Islands, as heard on Arena. Back after the break. Welcome back. Reid Darcy was getting all hot in his leathers when Grease star Olivia Newton-John came into studio. Yes, the actual studio.
I remember seeing her sing that song. Yeah, when I went to see Grease in Studio One in Kildare and she sang that song on the balcony, I thought she was singing it to me.
Ah, Ray. And maybe she was. Well, they say you should never meet your heroes, but in the case of Olivia Newton-John, they might just be wrong. She seemed absolutely lovely. She talked about getting the part of Sandy in Grease and having to shave more than a few years off her age to play the part.
You were?
I was 29.
And you played a
17, I guess.
17, 18 year old.
And I was really worried about it. When I look back now, I think, what were you thinking? But, you know, it's all relative to then. So I was really unsure about making this movie. I was unsure about whether I could pull it off because my musical career was taking off. I had made a movie in England in the 60s that was a musical called Tomorrow. And that didn't happen. So I thought, I don't want to make another movie. I might mess up, you know, what's happening. So John Travolta came to my house to convince me because he wanted me for the role. And he said, look, love, none of us are in our teens. The whole cast is going to be older, so don't worry about it. This is Hollywood.
Hollywood indeed. And Olivia Newton-John was first diagnosed with cancer in 1992. And she's been treated for cancer at three different times in her life at this stage. And she spoke to Ray about mortality.
Did I read somewhere that you said that cancer has made you live life better?
Yeah, well, I think it has. I think, as I'm saying, you know, the awareness of life and its fragility, and that I'm lucky to be here, especially three times. And, yeah, I'm just very grateful.
And are you spiritual? Or what do you believe in an afterlife?
I am. I think it's everything's possible.
Right.
And I've always... Yeah, I chant with my Buddhist friends. I pray with my cow girlfriend, Audrey. She was a strict Catholic, and I went to Mass with her. I respect everyone's belief system, and I think that whatever gets you through, whatever makes you happy and makes you less fearful of death, because I think that's what a lot of us are, that's why we choose a faith, because I think it helps us with that greater fear, because we're probably the only species that are aware of our mortality.
Mm.
So,
so it's whatever comforts you. Whatever works for you.
I said, oh, I wear a beautiful cross that was given to me in my hospital by one of the beautiful people that work there. And so it's all possible. How could it be this beautiful and not something greater than us, right? Whatever that is.
What a lovely woman. Well, maybe it was the girl next door transformed into the spandex catsuit vamp. But for Mary, who phoned into Ray, Olivia Newton-John was a third person in her marriage.
Really and truly, we have lived you in our lives for 40 years.
Right.
I'm so sorry, Mary.
Why don't you do your hair like Olivia? Olivia Newton-John's hair is gorgeous. I'll tell you what, no, I met John 40 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And it was Sam was the song that was out at the time.
Oh, Sam, I love that song.
And then we broke up. We just had a little fallout. And it was Hopelessly Devoted got us back together.
Oh, my goodness.
And that is 40 years ago, Olivia.
Well, I'm so happy that you got back together.
Well, you got us together, girl.
That's great. That's so sweet.
And Mary wasn't the only one feeling the love for Olivia. When she was out of earshot and out of studio, we heard this.
While you were listening to No Oakden Sport, I donned a leather jacket and a white T-shirt and pretended to be a bald John Travolta.
A smitten Ray D'Arcy. On Seascapes, reporter Gráinne McPolan spoke to Marie Kuzman-Barto about her project Piano Ocean that combines sailing and, well, the piano. Her boat is a 40-foot schooner called Lady Flow, which has been modified to accommodate her piano.
Two main sails, no front sail, and there's this back cabin there that you can see, and the piano fits in it. So we lift the boom and then we open the hatch, and the piano is lifted with an electric winch onto the deck for the concerts, and then we lower it into the back cabin for the sailing.
It's quite ingenious. But why was it so important for her to travel on water?
Sailing was maybe the more honest way of traveling, because you arrive by the sea and people know that it's not... You didn't drive, you didn't take the train or the plane. You've struggled in some way to arrive here. And you've been through storms, you've been waiting for the good winds, you've been, you know, shaking in the huge waves. And so when you arrived by the sea, the people know that you've made an effort to arrive and to reach them.
And all of this started when Marika was living in Galway about 10 years ago, when something in the harbour there caught her eye.
First time I saw the old ships, the Galway hookers, sailing in Galway Bay, I was just astonished. That was just beautiful. And I promised myself that one day I'd put my piano on a sailboat and sail around the world with it.
Marieke Housman-Barto with Piano Ocean, as heard on Seascapes. Over on Dave Fanning at the weekend, Brian Redden was talking about banned films and the implementation of the Hays Code, which took something of a twister approach as to how couples could behave in the bedroom.
Married couples in Hollywood movies had to be in single beds. You couldn't see them in the same bed. And if you did see a married couple in the same bed, then the husband had to keep one leg on the ground at all times. These are the rules set out in making. That's why you see...
very kinky sex movie.
No, yeah. But you see all these early movies with, you know, Spencer Tracy and Catherine Hepburn. It's usually separate beds. Or they're very rarely in bed together.
Yeah.
So there wasn't an awful lot of sex in the early movies to be banned anyway. But any reference to it, any hint of it, that led to a film being banned in Ireland.
And one banned film stood out in particular. This was Woody Allen's 1973 classic Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. And if you love animals but not too much, just the right amount, that's fine. But, well, let's just say Woody took it a little too far.
Why was it banned for everything?
Well, you'd think it was banned for everything, but it wasn't. It was banned because of one particular scene within the movie, which is so out there, where Gene Wilder is having an affair with a sheep.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that scene?
So bestiality is not cool in Ireland. Is that what you're saying?
Bestiality is not cool in Ireland. It's not
allowed.
It wasn't
then and it isn't now.
It was never cool. Never cool to bring a sheep on a date. Right. But in that film, he falls in love with a sheep and he brings the sheep to a hotel room. And he has his way, his evil way with the sheep. In fact, you think he dresses the sheep in suspenders at one point. And it wasn't even that got it banned. But afterwards, he lay on the bed of the sheep and said to the sheep, it was the best lay I ever had. He says to the sheep, and that's what got it banned. The fact that he enjoyed it so much.
Oh.
So bestiality and
it's okay
enjoying
if you didn't enjoy it. Off you go.
If you did it and didn't enjoy it, it was okay. But enjoying it so much led to that film being banned in 1973.
Brian Redden and Dave Fanning having a little bit too much fun there on the moral fencing around the wayward flock. On Drive Time, Kate O'Malley marked 50 years since the very first airing of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And of course, it's said that the secret to comedy is timing. And in this case, it really was.
So when Python was being recorded and when it eventually came out in 69, it was the beginning of the digital age for television. And very crucially, when you think about the animations and whatnot that Terry Gillingham was doing, it was colour. And this was huge. And this is what makes Python, I think, transcend the generations, this kind of colour moment in television. So that's one really important thing. The second important thing is the variety of performers and writers. So there's something for everyone. So you have cleverness and silliness. You have rudeness and sophistication. Lots of visual comedy, lots of verbal comedy. So there's kind of something for everyone there. And they had some innovations in the production techniques. Obviously, famously, they didn't have punchlines. They had the false beginnings and the false endings, you know, so a little bit of kind of difference there. But I think the most important thing about what happened in 69 and with the airing of the Flying Circus was that they had a new time slot, and that was at 10:30 on a Sunday evening. And because of that, they had what they described as a non-executive comedy moment. No executives were paying attention to what they were doing because they thought nobody was watching. But what was happening was that people were coming home from the pubs and they were all watching, and they had this sense of freedom. And I think this is what they think is really crucial in the beginnings of this kind of cult success for the Flying Circus in particular, that they got away with murder effectively.
So that's the key, eh? That was Kate O'Malley on Drive Time, which brings us shamelessly to playing this sketch, one which feels curiously apt.
Is this the right one for an argument?
I've told you once.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
When? Just now. No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
I did.
Didn't.
I'm telling you, I did.
You did not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this a 5-minute argument or the full half hour?
Oh, just the 5-minute one.
Fine. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
No, this isn't an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. It's just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
It is. You just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you did.
No.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument's a connected series of statements to establish a definite proposition. It isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument's an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
Not at all.
No, look.
Thank you.
Hard to believe that's 50 years old. That was a clip from Monty Python's Flying Circus as heard on Drive Time. Adrian McGinty spoke to Sean Rocks on Arena. A one-time writer, he had decided to quit the business. Jaded and working as a taxi driver, he got a late-night phone call from a literary agent who just wouldn't take no for an answer.
Hi there, I'm calling from Hollywood, California. I'm Shane Salerno. And I just go, oh my God,
who's this? Somebody from Hollywood, County Down, winding me up.
Yeah, I thought, who's this guy? And so he's talking away to me for about 5 minutes about how he's Don Winslow's agent. And I'm so tired and I'm done with all this business. So I just hung up on him. And I guess not many people hang up on this guy.
But was this before or after? Because I think he did say to you, you know, you got to write something. And not only that, what if I said to you, I'll wire $10,000
so that,
$10,000 into your bank account tonight?
That happened in that conversation. He said to me, what is the stumbling block that's preventing you from writing? And I said to him, well, we've no money. I've got two full-time jobs. I'm looking for more. And he said, all right, I really respect your talent. I want to see what you're doing next. I'll wire $10,000 into your bank account tonight. And I said, I can't take $10,000. I have no idea who you are.
And I want your bank account number. And you think, here comes the scam.
Yeah. And he said, Google me. And I said, I'm not Googling you. I said, I can't take charity. And he said, oh, no, I don't do charity. I'll give you a book for the next book that's in your head. I just want to see it. This will be an advance on your advance. Do you have an American story in you? And I'd been thinking about this story, The Chain, for about 5 or 6 years.
The Chain had its roots in those nasty chain letters that were in fashion in the late 70s that threatened that if you didn't continue the chain, something very bad would happen. Adrian took that concept but gave it a kind of a grown-up twist.
I'm pitching him this novel. I said a woman's driving to her oncologist in Boston and she gets this phone call from a frantic stranger who's kidnapped her daughter and said the only way you get your daughter back is if you kidnap someone else and pay the ransom and continue this chain. So I pitched this story to Shane and Shane goes, oh my God, I love that story. Send me chapter one. And I go, there's no chapter one, mate. There's nothing. And he says, well, just send me the outline. He says, there's no outline. And I said, what have you got? And I said, nothing. It's just in my head. And he says, oh, my God, what are you doing right now? And I go, nothing. And he goes, oh, well, just write me chapter one. And he's a very persuasive man. So I find myself at 2:30 in the morning writing the first 30 pages of the chain.
And did it come easily?
Well, it did actually, because I'd clearly been thinking about it for years.
Yeah.
And I hadn't written anything for over a year. And so clearly something was pent up and it all came pouring out. And so I wrote the first 30 pages, sent it off to him by email, and then went upstairs to my wife. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning. And she's going, what are you talking about? What's happened? You know, think I'm on the phone to a Nigerian prince and who needs some money. And then the phone goes at like 4:15. And of course, it's Shane again.
4:15 in the morning.
Yes. And he goes, oh my God, Adrian, those 30 pages, I just read them. We just need 300 more exactly like it. And I just go, oh my God. And he goes, Adrian, what time is it there? And I go, it's 4:15 in the morning. He says, oh wow, that's late. You should go to bed. You have a book to write. And he hangs up on me.
How about that for a story? That was Adrian McGinty on Arena. And Adrian now has a 6-figure book deal and a 7-figure film deal for that forthcoming novel, The Chain. And to play this next track is a cliche. I'm not going to deny it, but it's a cracker, so up you get.
Silence.
a song that is, of course, the chain from Fleetwood Mac. And it is a crime to fade, but fade we must. That's all we have for you here on Playback. Thank you for listening, and talk to you next week.